as much as history is a very difficult and painful place, there's also incredible stories of resistance, of finding power, finding voice, of finding oneself, finding others, of self-actualization, of hope, of possibility. Those exist as well and need to be celebrated as well.
Hello and welcome. This is Queer Recollections. It's a podcast where we're exploring and rethinking queer British history. In this episode, I'm talking to Justin Bengry, who you heard at the beginning. He's an academic who convened the world's first queer history MA at Goldsmiths. I thought this would be a really good place to start to try and find out why this subject, queer history, is worth our attention, what pitfalls there might be along the way, and what's the best way to approach it. I put to him a question that I often get when I talk about the subject, which is, why bother learning about it? And this is what he said.
I don't want people to think that queer history is some minority interest of minority significance, some tangent to the real story that we're sort of playing with off to the side. But actually, this contributes to a fuller, richer picture of our shared histories. So for instance, my own work, Into the Pink Pound, I look at homosexuality and capitalism impacts all of us. So some of the questions that I ask that also speak to queer history have a much wider impact. That being said, queer history does impact some people more than others. And some people do see in queer history their own lives, their own experiences, their own forebears in a way that not everyone does. So it offers both this really important corrective to what history has left out as a discipline, but it also should speak to everyone interested in a wider history.
Do you think there are problems of teaching this history? I'm thinking here maybe the issue of teaching the history as a sort of unproblematic linear history of progress, and also the kind of ahistorical application of labels onto the past that people at the time necessarily wouldn't have understood about themselves.
Well, I think you've hit on exactly one of the reasons why it is important to teach queer history, because we challenge both of those things. I've seen a lot of assumptions, wider assumptions, about this ahistoricity, that certain identities that are familiar now have always been, always will be, and people that look familiar to us in the past must have understood their gender and sexual identities, their experiences with others, in exactly the same way that we do now. And historians of all sorts would just rankle at that. That completely goes against everything we believe as historians, that lives, experiences, and how we interact with each other, with the state, are historically specific and must be contextualized in an historical moment. That's not to say that there's no resonance, that there's no continuities, but it's to say that those are situated within a particular historical moment. So that's really one of the really important reasons for studying queer history, is to have conversations about those issues and about change over time and about how it's okay to find forebears and antecedents and people who look familiar in the past and are important to us. But to truly honor them, we need to examine and recognize how they're different from us as well.
Do you think studying the subject is inherently political?
Yes, I think so. There's still so much work to be done to agitate for greater reform, to find equality for those of us that don't yet have it fully. And by doing queer history and provoking these questions and thinking about who has been left out and marginalized even within LGBTQ communities and histories, we are challenging both the state, the church, but also our own activist communities to do more and to do better.
Mm. Do you ever get pushback? I'm thinking here about members of the community who contest the versions of history that you're telling.
There's less pushback against me than what I've seen against some of my female colleagues or younger colleagues. So there is a degree of privilege that I have in this position that insulates me from some of that pushback and some of that contestation. I suppose one thing that I have gotten a bit of is concern over the use of the word queer. But even that, it's been interesting. I've watched my female colleagues get much more animated pushback than me. And I think it is, again, back to those issues of privilege of who I am. But I appreciate that queer is a contested term. In the academy, it's perfectly appropriate for a academic program of research to use queer. There's 30 years now, more than 30 years of academic discussion about queer as an organizing principle, as a term of identification, as an umbrella, all of these things. There are many people of a certain age for whom it is only a vicious term of abuse. And we have to acknowledge that. And I try to make that clear when I do give talks, that I fully acknowledge that, and that that is one part of the story of the word queer. But it also can't be the only story. And there are many people today, and there are many people in the past that use the term as one of self-identification as well. So what we have to do is think about the broadest range of uses of the term queer, how it's used, what it opens up for discussion, who it includes, and be open to having those conversations. But I suppose that's one area where I've had a bit of pushback. But overall, actually, there's not been too much.
I mean, I don't think all the pushback's necessarily bad, as you said. And it's also an unfolding history, and I think people feel like they have a stake in it.
Exactly.
It gets really personal.
Exactly, which is heartening. Like when people are pushing back, it's actually a good sign that they're invested in the questions. I'd rather have them invested and challenging me than not participating, bored or dismissive. It's also really useful for my students who might not even have questioned the use of queer, because they've just grown up with it being in the air. It's just perfectly unproblematic to them. So it's good for them to see me be challenged or be challenged themselves to think about that and to revisit their own assumptions.
I mean, on that point, how important do you think it is to have a personal connection to the history, particularly when talking about queer history? Do you think it's an important or even a necessity for teaching the subject?
For myself, as a gay man, I found particular resonance in these histories and was drawn to studying queer histories as I was learning about myself and grappling with my own identity and coming out. Certainly that's the case with many of my students as well, most of whom have openly identified as LGBTQ as well. And it's useful to have that really personal connection to those whom you research and the topics that you study. It brings passion to the questions. It gives weight and heft to what you're doing, and makes it, if it's resonant for you, that's going to come out in the work that you produce, the research that you present, the talks that you give, the communities that you work with. But it shouldn't be a limiting factor on who is allowed to do queer history. I certainly wouldn't want to be in an academy or in a, any type of research environment or historical environment in which someone is deemed not quote unquote gay enough to be doing this history. I think that would be horrific, because there's all kinds of reasons why someone might be researching these histories or drawn to these histories, and their own sexual identity does not need to be a part of that. And I certainly don't want to dismiss someone or disallow them from being part of the club of queer history because they're not gay enough.
Can you think of any reasons why there's been this hive of activity around queer history and around ways of grappling with it, or do you not see it like that?
I think there's been a growth in interest in queer history with the number of anniversaries that we've been celebrating for a number of years now. And that certainly seems to have seen an uptick both in the number of events, the organizations that are including it within their remit, within their program of events, and therefore people that are exposed to queer histories as valuable and valid parts of our shared history. So we had the 50th anniversary of the partial decriminalization of homosexual acts between men in 2017. And that seems to have really got the ball rolling. And of course, now we've had Stonewall last year. This year, we have the Gay Liberation Front. In 2 years, we're going to have the 50th anniversary of the first Pride in the UK. So all of these things are going to keep interest levels elevated and keep events actively moving forward. So I think that is a good thing. It certainly is. These anniversaries overrepresent some groups more than others, particularly gay white men, gay cis white men. But as a starting point, that can also open up conversations about all kinds of other wider LGBTQ histories. I think the only thing to bear in mind is that there are moments where we have a lot more of these events happening. And I remember in 2017, it just seemed like there was so much going on and people were already lamenting, saying that, well, great, we're having all of these things this year for the 50th anniversary and watch next year when it's all gone. And of course, it's going to diminish because there's going to be other anniversaries and other interests, but it's never gone away. And I think it stayed at a more elevated rate than it was before that. So I think I think this interest, especially from major bodies, major cultural bodies, museums, archives, libraries, cultural institutions, hasn't really abated massively. I mean, maybe it's not part of their day-to-day program all the time, but they're still doing more events and more talks and more features than just during LGBT History Month. So it's been, and I mean, a lot of them also, if they're a publicly funded organization, at least in the UK, they have a statutory obligation to recognize gender and sexual diversity in their programming. And so there's been a greater interest in that for some years now. And some organizations like Historic England were already doing this before 2017 and in advance of the anniversaries. So there is something important to be said there for the power of statutory obligations to do really good work that have longer implications and longer term consequences that push and drive change in other organizations as well.
Do you think there's a right or a wrong way to memorialize this history?
Well, the right way would be a more inclusive, diverse telling of history. There's innumerable wrong ways of doing it, which as an historian, I get irked at all the time if I see poorly researched histories or histories that don't acknowledge, say, the really important work that people have done in the past already. But focusing on what the best ways of doing and memorializing queer histories are is more useful. And I think it really is about telling stories of real people, of including the widest range and diversity of people, of including communities in how those stories are told. All of those things make queer histories more relevant, more relatable, and just more exciting and dynamic to people.
How do you find that process at the moment of research? Is it particularly difficult? Is it, you know, bits and bobs that here and there, or how is it at the moment?
I find there's a lot to work with, but I've also got now the experience of the better part of 20 years of doing queer history and doing archival research. So I suppose what some people see as isolated fragments, I see as many, many, many pieces to a puzzle, even if some are missing. I'm often overwhelmed by the amount of information that I can uncover historically or that I can find in records held in collections across the country digitally or those that I might create myself through oral histories. That being said, there's more material available for some questions, for some people's lives, and for some identity positions than for others. like I said, my research is into economic questions. There's lots of information about the economy. There's lots of information about cultural products that were commercial products. So I have, oh my gosh, I probably have hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that I can use in my research that I just have in my possession now, let alone everything that exists. But I work in the 20th century as well. For someone that is working in an earlier period or is looking at anyone more marginal than gay men, for instance, there's going to be less available. But that doesn't mean there's nothing available. We're also in a really exciting and challenging moment now where we are revisiting sources and historical writing in the past to ask new questions of it. So we've become rightly more attuned to questions around gender identity and around trans histories. And there's a lot of people who have been written about in the past, not as trans people, not as gender nonconforming people, but as gay people, lesbians, what have you. And their stories are much more complicated and not necessarily one or the other, but we are now revisiting those previously written histories, those already uncovered lives, and asking new questions about them. So there is more and more queer history to uncover and more existing queer history to review and revisit.
It's a strange one maybe, but do you ever get emotionally exhausted considering that you share sometimes the identity of the people you're studying and you're kind of immersed in it every day, or do you not really think about it like that, or are you just numb to it?
I have not yet ever spoken to a single person doing gender history, queer history, who has not at one point cried in the archives. We've all had moments where something catches us in a way we don't expect. We may have read thousands of stories, gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching stories of people, of lives cut short, of emotional trauma, of physical trauma, and we have to do that. That's our job. And we do get immune sometimes to the issues, and then it crops up, and then you read something that just hits you, and you stop, and it's a bit too much. And every single person doing queer history to a person will have that story, and most likely at a moment they weren't expecting it. It is a challenging one. I now have to, in the induction each year for the MA queer history students, we discuss that history is unkind and unforgiving and violent and dangerous, and that they are going to be confronted and triggered in queer history, especially, with every horrific thing they can imagine and many that they can't. So history is not always a happy place. It is not even very often an inclusive and welcoming place. It can be, but it's very often in queer history, what the stories that we have are those stories of people who have been most harmed by the state, the church, their families, other communities, what have you. The more violence that has been enacted upon them, the better for historians, because it leaves more records. Someone who happily goes through their lives with no distressing interactions with anybody leaves very few records. Those who have been most violently assaulted by the state leave the most records.
Do you think queer history should be taught in schools, and how?
Yeah, well, I definitely think it should be. I regret that it isn't in many places. Although we have examples in places like California, where by statutory obligation, schools are including LGBTQ history at all grade levels. So I think that's a really important thing and a really important solution. I don't think that history is necessarily always the answer, though, because I'd like to see discussions of LGBTQ people, their lives and experiences across curricula, across classes. It need not only be just history, but can fit into any class, any discipline within school, and doesn't have to be, all right, today we're going to talk about gay music, or we're going to talk about homosexuality in science. It can just be a matter of noting that, say, in a music class, that Benjamin Britten lived with his partner, Peter Pears, and they were both well-known in music fields as part of a conversation about 20th century British music. It need not be the entire focus of the lesson and can be an aside comment that just integrates the fact of LGBTQ people's lives and experiences throughout time and throughout discussions. This has been proposed really usefully by schools out as usualizing, which I think is such a better term than normalizing. Normalizing is probably the more common term still, but really has this baggage of sort of normal is better. And it suggests a kind of invisibilizing of those that fall outside of what's good and normal. But not a lot of us want to be normal. Usualizing, I think, is such a great term because it just makes these issues, these lives, these identities around LGBTQ experience ordinary. Part of the fabric of our lives and of society, and doesn't make them exceptional.
Do you think that for queer people, knowing and learning about your history is important in that process of, you know, self-realization and acceptance?
I think it is, because having a history means you're not alone. And seeing people in the past that you can identify with situates you in a different way. It might be that the people that you're identifying are much more different from you than you realize, or that you might be falling prey to some of the essentialist and ahistorical issues that we spoke about at the beginning of our conversation. But that doesn't mean that it's less powerful for you, even if I would argue about historical questions. I think it is important for people to have a sense of their place in a wider span of history, that they're not alone, that there are people like them that have existed in the past, because it gives them an anchoring in the present as well.
I guess maybe one we haven't spoken about so much is the future of the course and where you hope it might lead.
I'd like to see in the field, I suppose, it's already happening, but I'd like to see increasing attention and navigation of how we deal with trans histories. And that's not just a question of including trans histories and telling trans histories, because there's a number of people, including trans scholars themselves, that are doing a very good job of that already. But I think there's a responsibility among the rest of us to ask questions about what understanding transgender means for questions about our own research and the people that we study, and what queer history looks like going forward in that light. And I think that's really an exciting opportunity. Historians of sexuality have often used gender nonconformity very straightforwardly as a signal of sexual diversity. And it isn't always the case. It can be, but it isn't always, and it isn't only that. So we need to revisit some of those questions. Actually, this person is trans, and we need to know more about how they understood their gender identity. This their gender nonconforming behavior isn't purely an expression of their sexuality, and also their gender identity isn't. And sexuality aren't the same thing. They can be trans and lesbian, or trans and bisexual. And too often, historians of sexuality have looked at these as entirely uncomplicated categories that don't need to be thought of in ways that interact with one another.
Are there topics that you struggle to include within queer history?
I struggle with including some topics around... especially around colonial histories and more a wider geography of queer history, because the research might not actually be available in English, or might not actually be done. And I don't always want to default to American history either. This is another area I struggle with, is that it's such a bigger academy in the States and so many more people working that on almost any question, it's easy just to have American history as the readings, which I'm really, really reluctant to do. At first I was afraid, as someone whose specialization is British history, that I would have too much British history. But in fact, the danger has always been defaulting to American history.
Mm, just to pick up on what you were saying about the American histories, I just remember in school, I've always thought it was bizarre that we learn about Black history in the American context, but never in the British context.
Yeah, I've heard this, that people get the civil rights movement, but nothing about here.
It's honestly bizarre. And I'm sure someone is out there doing that corrective work, but it's interesting how, you know, in American context, it's assumed that there is this kind of social movement history, and then here there's an assumption that there isn't. So,
right, which is really interesting. Yeah. Now, Black British history question, certainly that's exactly the point taken up by my colleague Christina Fryer, who's started this year on getting the MA Black British History set up, and she's made exactly the point that you have. And wants to remedy that. And it's interesting, and both of us are, she's American, I'm Canadian, both of us are North Americans saying, what's going on in this funny country we've moved to that they're doing American history rather than actual British examples that students might relate to?
Yeah, it's funny, you are. Sometimes you need that outside perspective to be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I always find it fascinating, this sort of, I try to push back against this, and it's more than just British, it is a global thing, but this fetish for Stonewall, when in fact there are really interesting local activist histories that at the moment had more, at the moment of them happening, had more impact than Stonewall did in local contexts. These questions of historical memory are really interesting, and Stonewall has become this useful icon that people can know that others know about and signal their awareness by speaking it. But they don't talk about, say, I think it was 1971, there was a demonstration in Highbury Fields, which was the first activist gay demonstration in the UK. Or they're just coming to grips with histories of, say, Section 28, which would have impacted your schooling, for instance.
A quick aside for those that don't know, Section 28 was a law passed in 1988 by the Conservative government of the time, and it banned, and I quote, promoting the teaching of the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. And it was finally repealed in 2003. It's something I really want to do an episode on, because a lot of people don't know that their own schooling was affected by this legislation.
We have an awareness of Section 28, but there's no good book that I'm aware of about Section 28. There's no history of the Gay Liberation Front yet. There's personal memoirs, but there's no rigorously researched history. These are massive, massive, massive gaps in British and UK queer histories that are unconscionable.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's a huge opportunity and really exciting.
Exactly, yeah. I this is why I keep hoping one of my students will continue on to a PhD, and I can say, you need to write the history of Section 28. You need to do a critical history of the GLF. You need to do all of these other things. There's definitely a lot of opportunity. There are, I mean, maybe this is an issue that didn't come up in the podcast. There are, I have concerns about people getting into academia as a profession now. And not just now in this sort of COVID-19 context, but even in the last few years, it's a very difficult profession to enter. It's a difficult profession in which to secure a stable, permanent position. Too much of academia relies on casualized and precarious labor. And for people that come from marginalized communities, that's even more dangerous. So I have such an ambivalence about recommending my best students to go on into academia when statistically they're unlikely to secure anything as near as stable as a job as I have. On the other hand, I don't want queer history only to be written and researched by the most privileged people that can afford to go into an uncertain career and not worry about the consequences.
That's a real dilemma. Do you think it's more difficult to secure these permanent positions if your research interests are in marginalized histories?
I'd have to look at the hiring statistics. I think it's difficult no matter what you research, but it could be that there are fewer opportunities for people that are doing work that is seen by many departments as still marginal to their core interests and their core clusters of research. I'd have the same concerns about people wanting to do Black British history from communities of color, or trans people studying trans histories and gender diversity. It's difficult with all the privilege in the world, and worse for those without or with less. But again, I want those voices of contestation and those voices of disruption and challenge and questioning in the academy, because the academy can be a very traditional and conservative place. And we need these voices from marginalized communities to challenge the academy and challenge the conservatism that is embedded in many disciplines, including history. I think we have to also really consider really pragmatic questions around employment and queer employment. We need to have histories of queer employment too. But I mean, we also need to think about policy and questions around queer employment and academic employment and precarity and the welfare state and how that the impact that's had on queer people specifically.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation and learned something as well about why we're looking at this subject, why it's important, and also the problems with it as well and how we might approach it differently. I think this sets us up really nicely now to talk about the history with people who have lived through it. So that's what we're going to be doing in the next episode. Until then, I'm Will, and this has been Queer Recollections.